This paid commercial may not represent the views of Hubbard Broadcasting Incorporated or Federal News Radio. Statements and opinions of this broadcast are solely those of individual contributors or advertisers as indicated. Federal News Radio does not take responsibility for those statements or opinions and accepts no responsibility or liability for any inaccuracy, errors, or omissions reported during this program. Welcome to Blueprint for Wealth, a program dedicated to securing your personal dreams of wealth and freedom. Now, here's your host, Wayne Zell.
Good morning and welcome to Blueprint for Wealth. I'm Wayne Zell, your host of this fast-paced half hour of special topics and special guests designed to help you realize your personal dreams of wealth and freedom. Blueprint for Wealth is brought to you by Odin Feldman and Pittleman, a law firm located in Fairfax, Virginia, but serving the entire Washington, D.C. metro area with clients all across the country. If you'd like to know more about our firm, visit us on the web at www.ofplaw.com or give us a call at 703-218-2100. Also, I invite you to subscribe to my blog, blueprintforwealth.org, where there's all kinds of interesting articles, videos, and of course, audio on topics of interest in tax, estate planning, and business planning. And lastly, I invite you to read my column in the Washington Business Journal, the first Friday of every month, entitled Blueprint for Wealth. Today, we're going to talk about the top 10 legal mistakes entrepreneurs make. You know, I can tell you all kinds of war stories, but this article is based on this segment is based on an article that was published by the Harvard Business School and specifically by Associate Professor Connie Bagley that reflected on conversations she had with her former students who had actually gone out and started business ventures. And to prepare her current students for a business planning contest, she gave a seminar in which she shared war stories from these prospective entrepreneurs in the form of a list of top 10 legal mistakes that were made by the unsuspecting entrepreneurs. There's a tendency on the part of many entrepreneurs that the lawyers can handle all their legal issues, and they may often delegate too much to the lawyers. The language of the law can be intimidating, and concepts are usually quite straightforward. Lawyers tend to be risk-averse, so if you delegate everything to your lawyer, you're going to stay out of legal trouble, but you could compromise your business goals and objectives. So a good business lawyer is somebody who's going to tell you what the legal risks are, but then outline for you the business risks associated with your decision process. And you may make a business decision not to take the most legal averse route. So on the top 10 list, number 10, falling in at number 10, is failing to incorporate early enough. One problem that arises here is the so-called forgotten founder, a partner who was helping and starting up the venture and then subsequently drops out. Then when the venture gets financing or goes public or is about ready to be sold, the partner surfaces, perhaps with an inflated view of what his or her contribution was, and demanding an equity stake in the business. Now, this, of course, can be eliminated by incorporating early and issuing shares to the founders with vesting requirements and often provisions in a shareholders agreement that says if you ever leave, the company or the remaining founders get to repurchase the shares. Incorporating early before significant value has been created and well in advance of any financing event that establishes a value for the shares also helps avoid potential tax problems for cheap stock that is given at the early stage. If you incorporate too late and issue inexpensive stock to the founders at that time, and more expensive stock is being sold to investors, you can have problems with the IRS later on. Number 9, issuing founder shares without vesting. I mentioned vesting. Vesting protects the members of the founding team who take the venture forward. If people remain on the team and are productive, their shares will vest. If they leave earlier, the stock can be retrieved and given to whoever is brought in to replace them. Number 8, hiring a lawyer who's not experienced in dealing with entrepreneurs and venture capitalists. Many venture capitalists and private equity investors say that often they rate the judgment of entrepreneurs by their choice of legal counsel. Lawyers who have no experience in working with entrepreneurs or venture capitalists will most likely focus on the wrong things, and they'll fail to recognize that some of the more subtle potential traps may be completely omitted in their planning. So hire somebody who's played the game, who knows what's standard and what isn't. Number seven, failing to make a timely Section 83B election. If you follow the advice above about issuing founder shares with vesting, then the shares will be issued subject to vesting to the founders as well as to new employees. If stock is acquired and it's subject to what the IRS calls a substantial risk of forfeiture, then the IRS doesn't view the purchase as being closed until that risk disappears. When the stock vests, the risk evaporates, so the IRS considers the deal closed. Then the IRS calculates the difference between the price paid for the stock and what the value is at the later date. An 83B election allows you to compute the tax based on the value at the time the shares are issued, not when they vest, which might be pennies per share, which reduces the overall income tax impact on the founders. Number six, negotiate venture capital financing based solely on a valuation. You know, valuation is not the only thing you should consider when selecting a venture capitalist or negotiating a deal. There are many other ways for venture capitalists to be compensated if they end up paying a high price for the shares. These include requiring participating preferred stock with a high dividend, or redemption rights that are exercisable after only a few years, or having anti-dilution protection that ratchets with no cap. These terms may be terms of art to you and be sound Greek to you, but they're critical in negotiating with a venture capitalist. You've got to ask, what's the reputation of the venture capitalist? Do they have a history of standing by the entrepreneur if the entrepreneur stumbles? Do they have good contacts in the industry? And do they know the big players? Number five mistake of the top 10 legal mistakes made by entrepreneurs is waiting to consider international intellectual property protection. Patents typically are granted on a country-by-country basis. In the U.S., if an invention is sold or made public, there's a year's grace period to file a patent application. But everywhere else, if the invention is sold or publicized prior to filing the patent, the invention is unpatentable in the country. For example, if the invention is disclosed to a Japanese national visiting a trade show in the U.S., then under Japanese patent law, if no patent application has been filed, the disclosure makes the invention unpatentable in Japan. The same goes for trademarks. So, it might cost a lot of money, but an intelligent choice would be to file for patent and trademark protection both internationally and in the U.S. if you want to protect your intellectual property. Number four, disclosing inventions without having a non-disclosure agreement or before filing the patent application. If the patent protection has not been obtained, or in cases where a patent is not available, the only protection is to maintain something as a trade secret. So to do so, you have to show that you've taken reasonable steps to keep it secret from competitors. Is it wise to get potential venture capitalists to sign a non-disclosure agreement? In the best of all worlds, yes, but most won't do it. Before disclosing, one must learn who has a reputation for integrity. In dealing with most people, it's wise to require them to sign non-disclosure agreements. It doesn't have to be elaborate, but it should say that they acknowledge that they may be exposed to trade secrets and they agree not to use or disclose them without permission. Business plans should expressly state on the cover page that they're confidential and proprietary. Now, it may not be as strong as a non-disclosure agreement, but it's a start. Number three, start your business while employed by a potential competitor or hiring employees without first checking their agreements with the current employer for knowledge and knowledge of trade secrets. Hey, the law is clear. If somebody is working for a company, particularly if he or she is a key employee, they cannot operate a competing business. Even incorporating may spark a lawsuit from the employer. Would-be entrepreneurs should go first to their current employer and either resign or tell them what they're doing and ask if they'd be interested in investing. Amazingly, it's a very smooth way of ending the relationship. Even after leaving the current employer, you still may not be able to use or disclose the employer's trade secrets. Under the so-called inevitable disclosure doctrine, if somebody's been exposed to trade secrets at their job and they leave to work for somebody else, and if their responsibilities in the new job are similar to what they were doing in the old job, some courts will conclude that it's inevitable that they'll use the information that they had from the earlier position. It also helps to know whether potential recruits are subject to covenants not to compete or non-hire covenants. The states vary from state to state in terms of what's enforceable or not. The bottom line is, check with a lawyer before going out and doing what you're thinking of doing. Number two on the list of the top 10 legal mistakes that most entrepreneurs make is promising more in the business plan than can be delivered and failing to comply with state and federal securities laws. If somebody promises to do something and knows that they cannot perform that promise, that is considered fraud. In a business plan, you have to make an honest appraisal of what's doable and set forth your assumptions so the person who puts up money and invests in your business can judge on whether or not those assumptions are realistic. Can entrepreneurs be sued by their funders for fraud? Absolutely. Yes. Trying to squeeze out a little extra valuation by fudging the numbers erodes credibility, or by overstating the assumptions, and it makes investors less trusting and ultimately impairs your ability to get subsequent rounds of funding. Finally, anybody selling stock or other securities has to comply with both federal and state securities laws, either by registering or meeting the requirements for an applicable exemption. And with the crowdfunding legislation that was recently passed, it may become easier to raise money in a startup context. The last mistake is thinking that any legal problems can be solved later. There's a tendency to think that once I get my funding, once I'm up and running, then I've got time to hire the lawyers and the money. Right now, I'm running as fast as I can to get my business plan done and raising money. This is short-sighted. Many of the points made here are problems that can't be patched up later. Does that mean you should devote all your time and effort and money to legal issues? No, but it's a good reason to hire a competent lawyer experienced in handling startups. If you've got questions about startups, give us a call at 703-218-2100. I'm Wayne Zell, and you're listening to Blueprint for Wealth.
You're listening to Blueprint for Wealth with Wayne Zell. Learn how to better prepare for your future when Blueprint for Wealth returns in a moment.
A Legal Minute with Wayne Zell.
Should a business lease or buy equipment? For companies that rely heavily on equipment to produce their services or products, deciding on whether to lease or buy can be a critical aspect. Even for businesses that rely more heavily on retail or other business models, financing equipment to start the business can be very expensive. It should be resolved before you approach investors or others for financing. Buying equipment guarantees ownership over important resources for the business for the long term, but it can be very expensive, especially in fields where equipment and technology rapidly become obsolete. It can be cost prohibitive to maintain the newest and most advanced equipment. Leasing, on the other hand, offers more flexibility for updating outdated equipment and may be cheaper in the short term. The downside to leasing is that over time, the costs of leasing may outweigh the costs of owning the equipment. Each business owner has to consider his or her needs of the business and the amount of money that will be invested before deciding whether to lease or to buy.
Welcome back to Blueprint for Wealth, a program dedicated to securing your personal dreams of wealth and freedom. If you have questions for Wayne, you can email him at radio@ofplaw.com or call him at 703-218-2100. Now back to your host, Wayne Zell.
Welcome back to Blueprint for Wealth. I'm Wayne Zell, and with me today is our special guest, Doug McPherson, who's a broker representative at Lara, Scholl & May in Falls Church, Virginia. Welcome, Doug.
Thank you.
Welcome
Enjoy
to the show. Great to have you. And doing the interviewing is my special guest partner, John Dedon, who is one of our premier trusts and estates lawyers and represents clients all across the country on all matters relating to trusts and estates. He is probably one of the best T&E lawyers in the country. Welcome, John, and thanks for being here today.
Wayne, thank you, and thanks for those nice comments. You know, along those lines, we have one of the experts in the financial area here with us. Doug, I'm glad you're here. Tell us a little bit about how you got into the business as a financial planner.
Well, I started in the early 70s and thought it would be great to be in the planning business because I thought that the financial opportunities would be pretty exciting, and started with an insurance carrier and then ultimately decided I wanted to be independent and be on my own.
And you've been in D.C. Since then?
No, I've been in was in the Baltimore area. That's where I started, and came down to D.C. Even though all of our clients, or many of them, were in the D.C. area, I was living in Baltimore and moved down here about 10 years ago.
And you're originally a D.C. native, or you're from some other place?
No, I was from Massachusetts originally, and then moved to Baltimore, and then was up there for some time, and then now I'm down here.
Excellent. Now, you're kind of unique in that not that you're a financial planner, because there are a lot of financial planners, but you've really zeroed in on the construction and contracting business.
Our clients are all in the construction and aggregate industries, and I found them to be just really a truly exciting group of people.
You know, I remember when I began to focus on estate planning back in the early 90s, your name was always mentioned as one of the premier planners who had an expertise in that end. So it's just wonderful that we've had an opportunity to begin to work together. Tell me, what was it that attracted you to those types of clients?
Well, I started working with different people in the financial services field that needed the planning work. But when I got dealing with some construction people, it seemed like they were different. They did not seem to follow the things that the normal financial planner would say was, this is how it works.
You were going to say follow the rules.
Yeah. It's just that's a good point. Yes. The issue was that they just seemed to interpret this information differently.
So you had a challenge that you found in dealing with them that was different from other clients. What did you do to address that challenge?
Well, we came up with some ideas. First of all, I really like them. I'm a morning guy, and I used to see a lot of them early in the morning, which ruled out most financial planners because they like to show up at 9:30, and I was having lunch at 9:30, I'd meet them early. But I had a couple of psychologists out in California work with me, and they say there's something about these types of people, and we came up with three things. Of course, hindsight's always 20/20. It's pretty simple. But the first thing was that they are very high visual people. In other words, the visual component is huge, and they are really unusual in the population. And that's why for people in this industry, their idea of success is 480 trucks with my name on it.
Interesting. It really is. Yeah.
So you began to structure your presentation and the services you can provide with a heavy visual component.
Yes. The visual component was very, very important. They like pictures. In other words, don't show me a 20-page trust that I can bore myself by reading. Show me a picture of what it means and how it works.
What else did you find with the psychiatrists psychologists you hired?
Right. Well, and the second thing was that they like things done in sequence. Of course, when you're a construction contractor, you do things in a sequential way. You do things in steps. And they were not doing any of the step work in their planning. It was just meetings and stuff. So we created this process, which was sequential in nature. And then the third thing that we found was that they're very, very timeline oriented, meaning it had to be done by Wednesday at noon, a job. And it was a penalty if it wasn't, but a benefit if it was. So we created a succession and estate planning process for these construction-type people that had these three components. It was all and highly visualized. It was sequential in nature, and it had timelines and priorities put in, and it was just terrific.
You know, Doug, I find that fascinating that as you were trying to serve as clients, you went beyond simply saying, here's products or things that you could take advantage of. you went the next step and actually learned about their business and how to relate to them by getting the psychologists involved.
Well, we wanted them to be the architect of their plan, but then if you put it in a structure and a visual arrangement that they're used to, that's an important way for them to relate to it.
And that process started how long ago?
It started in 1977 when we started. And it's well known now and copyrighted here and overseas.
So tell me about that. It has evolved then into a process you take your clients through, and you've actually copyrighted that, and it's a proprietary product you have.
Yes, we found that we really didn't have much other competition relative to the type of work we do. There are a lot of planning people out there and a lot of advisors we work with, mm-hmm. but there was not a much of a process they went through. I used to have, when I would meet people, I'd say, I'm just tired of all these meetings. We all sit around and just look at stuff and read papers and this and that, and then we all say, well, we'll be in touch. And you know, and I say, you know, we need to have this all done in visuals and sequence and sequentially, and then timeline it.
And brings them to closure quickly.
Absolutely. And they're used to that, and they think that way.
Have you been able to apply it outside of the construction industry to other professions or other clients?
Well, this process would work for anyone that has this, but we've stayed focused on that. And having, in the area of the succession, we've done 184 succession plans over the last 42 years. And they're all sizes from small to very substantial. And so we've been really privileged with that. I think one of the challenges is when you move outside your niche, even though the process is good, you lose some things, and you got to stay in touch with these people all the time.
Well, I've seen firsthand how effective this is and how it has helped to get from the theory to actually beginning to implement. You know, it's also interesting to me, Doug. Wayne and I, as estate planners, we spend a lot of time looking at the estate tax, as you do, but we all recognize that there is succession planning issues that are just as important as any tax issues, and I know you spend a lot of time dealing with the succession planning as it relates to non-tax issues.
Well, the succession piece, you know, tomorrow has a way of showing up, and sometime you got to figure out if you're going to get off the truck. And I tell them, you're either driving it or you're under it, so let's figure it out.
Or in the back of it.
Or in the back of it, yes. So that's an important component.
Let's hear a little bit more about that, because I know you work with some of the leading contractors in the D.C. and Baltimore area, and these folks who are not working because they have to, they're working with, because they choose to, and sometimes that creates issues as they get on in life.
Well, one of the challenges that there's been a number of them, but one of the major challenges is that we spend so much time with these people, helping them work on a succession structure, and it may be family members, frequently sons, it could be key employees, or a combination of them, or we may end up selling the company. But the real issue for many of them is, I've been doing this for 45 years or whatever. What do I do now? I mean, what's next? And over the last 3 years, it's become very apparent that there are a lot of people that we have been working with, and we've worked through the succession component. But the question is now, what do I do? And we've created a process. It's called the Meaningful Future Process. And we've had some psychologists involved with that as well. But it's an 8-step process that helps the individual work through where he's going from this point forward. And we have some interesting stories that have come about because of our learning about this concern.
Any stories you can tell us?
Oh,
on air?
Sure. One fellow is very successful, and they have sons in the business, and they've done extremely well. And I was telling the wife in the meeting, she said, Doug, I need to chat with you on our own. She said, I know you said you're going to try and not retire him, but reinvent him. That's what we got to do. But here's what I want you to know. He left in the dark, and he came home in the dark, and we were married on weekends. And it's been great. I built my life, and she's got a very successful business on her own, and she gardens and bridges, plays bridge, and she's a magnificent person. She said, and it's been great. We have a great marriage. But she said, now you've done all the success and stuff, and now it's time for him to step away, and I just want you to know I don't want him emptying the dishwasher and asking me where we're going for lunch. She said, I married him for better or for worse, not for where we're going for lunch. And she said, and then she had tears in her eyes after that. She said, Doug, we will be divorced if you don't figure out something we can do. And they are very successful people financially. She said, you've got to do that. And we are helping him with our process. And it's been magnificent. It's worked very, very well. And it's been a perfect example of how this thing really works.
You know, that I think what you've illustrated by giving that example, that story, is really important. We do a lot of business succession planning, John and I do. Mm-hmm. We often don't think what happens afterwards. It's like doing a merger or an acquisition, a sale of a business. What happens to the people who leave the business afterwards? And some of them have goals and dreams and they can pursue them. But you really are helping them manage their lives and do so successfully.
Right. Well, for many of these people, you know, you think of, for people in general, you think, gee, they work till they're 65 and then they can go do what they really want. That's not what these people are like. They have been doing what they want.
Right.
And they've had opportunities and they've traveled and they've got boats or jets or who knows and play golf. And that's not it. The question is, what are they going to do that's going to be fulfilling and meaningful for them for the balance of their lifetime? And one of the things we use is the bucket list with Jack Nicholson. And,
sure.
And we go through that. And
Morgan Freeman.
Yeah, Morgan Freeman. I had a wife that's when we were doing that, I had his name on the bucket list, the husband's name, and she said, well, where's mine? And I said, oh. Sorry, yeah. And so now we'd have three bucket lists. It's got his name and it got her name and then our bucket
list.
Both,
right.
But we've got them prioritized in timeline and we're really working on it. And
how cool.
And one other component of this is the mortality reality, which is part of it. You know, when you figure out what your age is going to be, and we have this all done based on their age, and it doesn't mean you can't live to 100, but like if you're 70, you got 13 years. You know, that's not a lot of time to do a lot of stuff if you got
the clock is ticking.
It's ticking. And
the clock is ticking. I just want you to know.
Right.
So, Doug, it's clear there's a tax component to this.
Absolutely.
There's the company succession planning and incentive plans and key employees and so forth. But then the point that you're really bringing out is there's a personal component that's just as important.
Absolutely. And we don't think about that too much, but when you get to know these people, and it's the same for everyone. And I've gone through this process myself and working on my bucket list, and I just, there's, you know, we say, you got to remember now, you're not going to get out of this thing alive, so you better get on the truck and get her going. So.
Well, you know what's really interesting about this is you've evolved with the process you started 30, 35 years ago, and you've now been able to institute the same kind of timelines and priorities for the business owners on the personal side as well.
Well, it's they're familiar with our succession and the process. And by having the visual, sequential, and timeline components, it's worked magnificently well for these great people.
And I've seen that firsthand. It's something that's really of benefit to a lot of these business owners.
We're talking with Doug McPherson, who is a principal with Lara Shull and May, but also has the McPherson Critical Path Process. Doug, if people want to learn more about it or get in touch with you, how do they do that?
They can send us an email. That's email address is Doug M. That's Doug M at McPherson, McPherson.com, or they can call my direct number. It's 703-761-3913.
Excellent. Thanks for being a special guest on Blueprint for Wealth.
Well, thank you for having me here.
And John Dedon, thanks for being our special interviewer.
Thank you, Wayne.
And everyone, thanks for listening to Blueprint for Wealth. Join us next week for another special topic and special guest. Have a great week.
You've been listening to Wayne Zell and Blueprint for Wealth. Wayne will be back next Saturday morning at 10 a.m. with your Blueprint for Wealth right here on 1500 a.m.
I'm Beyonce with an important message about hunger in America. Did you know 1 in 8 people struggle with hunger? Over 12 million children live in homes where there isn't always enough food. Food banks are experiencing more demand than ever. Show Your Helping Hand is a nationwide campaign with the goal of helping Feeding America deliver millions of meals to local food banks. Please join me in showing a helping hand to fight hunger. More information is available at showyourhelpinghand.com.
This paid commercial may not represent the views of Hubbard Broadcasting Incorporated or Federal News.